Let's go then to the next chapter, which is about enzymes. You have thousands of chemical reactions occurring in your cell, and almost none of those thousands of chemical reactions, even though many of those are spontaneous, almost none of those are going to occur easily on their own. The conditions within the cell aren't right for even spontaneous reactions to happen without help, which is why you need catalysts. A catalyst is a general word from chemistry, right? A catalyst is something that is helpful in a reaction without actually being a reactant itself, right? So a catalyst isn't necessary for a chemical reaction to occur, and it's not a reactant because a reactant would get changed into a product. That doesn't happen for a catalyst. Instead, a catalyst is a bystander that actually participates, though, and allows reactants to turn into products much more easily than would occur without the catalyst's help. But after that process, since the catalyst isn't a reactant, it emerges from that unchanged. It's reusable, in other words, because it didn't get transformed itself like the reactants do. Well, we can see why catalysts are necessary in reactions by looking at these graphs. So notice that you have free energy here, G, not delta G. The value of free energy at any given moment, because reaction progress is the x-axis, which is basically another way of saying time, right? So at any given moment, there's a value for free energy in that system. Well, you have a beginning free energy and an ending free energy. In other words, a G of the reactants and a G of the products to the right of that. In any given reaction. This happens to be what kind of reaction based on these beginning and ending values of G. This is an exergonic reaction, correct. And in terms of the likelihood of it happening on its own, what would you call this reaction? This is a spontaneous reaction. Spontaneous mathematically because you have a lower value of G at the end, a higher value of G at the beginning. G final minus G initial is therefore negative, right? So the delta G for this reaction is, as labeled here, just the difference between that beginning and ending G, which, notice, does not have anything at all to do with the hump in the middle, right? All delta G cares about is the final and the initial values. But a reaction doesn't proceed in such a way that reactants just immediately become products. They don't just pop into the other conformation. In other words, a reaction, even though it might seem instantaneous to our perception, reactions occur over time. It takes a little bit of time for certain bonds to be broken and new bonds to be formed, which is what is happening in a chemical reaction, right? That's why you have reactants turning into products. It's reformation of chemical bonds. And so any given chemical reaction features what is called an activation energy, which is the E sub A here, energy of activation or activation energy. Notice that the activation energy graphically is the size of the hill over whichever G is higher, final or initial. Okay? But also notice that the energy of activation is higher, the peak of the trace is higher than either the final G or the initial G. And it would be the same case if we had a non-spontaneous reaction. The only difference is you would start out with a low G, go to a high peak, and then go down to a G that's still higher than the initial. All right. So it doesn't matter whether delta G is positive or negative. Energy of activation is higher than either beginning or final G. Well, the energy of activation corresponds, in terms of the progress of the reaction, to the formation of what's called a transition state. The transition state is a very unstable situation where you don't have a reactant or a product. You have somewhere in between. That's the time when bonds aren't really stable at all, because some bonds are kind of half broken, some bonds are half formed. It's the transition state. Very unstable, which is why that transition state features such a high G. Remember that the higher the value of G, the greater the instability, which is why things become more stable spontaneously, because they're lowering their free energy. They're going downhill energetically to a lower G. Well, the point here is that no chemical reaction is going to occur, whether it's spontaneous or not, unless there's enough energy to reach that energy of activation peak, which can be attained just by thermal energy, the motion of the particles involved, which is exactly why heating up a chemical reaction will make it more likely to proceed. This is what we see on the right side of the figure. At two different temperatures, so these are two different conditions. The black temperature line, T1, shows you a distribution curve for particles. It's like a histogram, right? Any given particle at any moment is traveling at its own speed. But the speed is its kinetic energy. You have a population of particles that are not all moving the same speed. That what we call the temperature is the average speed, but there are some fast ones, there are some slow ones, and it's a bell curve. All right. Within this bell curve, the farther you are to the right on it, the faster you are. And therefore, there's a certain percentage, shown by this little shaded area, that would be fast enough to actually get over that hump. And this is why a chemical reaction can proceed just because of the kinetic energy of the thermal motion, without any help from a catalyst. It's just that it's a small minority of ones that are doing it. So there's not going to be much progress in terms of formation of the product if you have a tiny fraction of the population with sufficient energy to get over that hump. But if you raise the temperature, which means increase the average speed, this whole thing shifts over to the blue trace. And now all of a sudden a much greater fraction of the population of particles is at sufficient speed. Right? That's why temperature is one way to speed up a reaction. And that's how we do things industrial often. We just heat it up. That's inappropriate for a cell, though, because heating the process up sufficiently for most of the biochemical reactions that need to occur would destroy the cell, right? Which wouldn't get us anywhere. So we have to rely on catalysts in order to get us over that hump without having to heat up. Well, that's what a catalyst does, and in all cases, whether it's an industrial catalyst, a non-biological catalyst, or a biological catalyst. What any given catalyst does, and therefore what every enzyme does, since enzymes are catalysts, is somehow reduce E sub A, which is what you're seeing down here on the lower left. The blue trace is the same exact reaction occurring with the help of a catalyst, an enzyme. The size of this E sub A, which is just this value, this vertical distance, is much reduced in the presence of the enzyme. Now, the enzyme can accomplish this various ways. For instance, it can make it much more likely for two reactants to get together because those reactants come in and temporarily bind to the enzyme. They're in the right orientation with respect to each other. Bonds can be stressed by the enzyme, etc. There are different ways in which enzymes work, but however they work, the thing that they all have in common, and all catalysts, is that they work by reducing energy of activation. Now, graphically appreciate the fact that no enzyme, no catalyst ever changes the value of delta G. The only thing it does is reduce energy of activation. So a catalyzed reaction is going to happen a lot quicker because it's going to be easier for the existing thermal energy to get you over this much lower hill. But final G and initial G are unaffected, and therefore delta G is unaffected by the catalyst. So the catalyst doesn't change spontaneity, and it doesn't change the amount of energy that's either required or liberated by a reaction. It just affects the speed. Okay, to slide 2. Well, biological catalysts come in 2 forms with respect to macromolecules. What am I talking about? What are the 2 forms? What are the 2 macromolecules that are catalytic? Biological macromolecules. Proteins and RNA. Therefore, the 2 categories of catalysts are what? Those are macromolecule classes. What are the catalysts called? You're overthinking this. Enzymes for proteins and ribozymes for RNA, yeah. Enzymes and ribozymes are both catalysts. So just the distinction between the names is based on what they're made of. The vast majority of biological catalysts are enzymes, proteins, made out of proteins. In fact, for a long time we said every biological catalyst is a protein, until we discovered fairly recently that RNA can do that job as well. That's important actually in the history of life because those were the original enzymes in the RNA world that predated our DNA world. Anyway, we're looking at a protein that's acting as a catalyst in slide 2. Therefore, this is an enzyme. And it doesn't matter that this is lysozyme. It's listed as lysozyme. That is just a specific enzyme. That's really not the point here. The point here is that an enzyme has on it somewhere an active site, which is part of its surface. It has a specific shape, and that active site is simply the part of the enzyme where catalysis occurs. In other words, the active site is the place where the thing that the enzyme is working on temporarily binds. And what is that thing that the enzyme is working on called in general? The substrate or substrates. Could be 1 or 2. Sometimes an enzyme will turn one thing into another one thing. Sometimes an enzyme will break one thing into 2. Sometimes it'll synthesize 2 into 1. So you can have 1 or 2 substrates, but they bind at the active site. This binding is reversible, importantly, right? An enzyme wouldn't do you much good if the substrate binds permanently. But the active site has a specific shape and therefore gives the enzyme specificity. There are a lot of industrial catalysts that are not specific. For instance, platinum metal can catalyze a lot of reactions, which is what happens in your catalytic converter, which is why they're expensive to replace, because platinum's more expensive than gold. What I mean here is that platinum can catalyze various things. It's not very specific. Enzymes, on the other hand, have high specificity. And that's because of that specific shape and chemical composition of the active site. This thing, therefore, this enzyme that we're looking at here, doesn't do anything unless it has its specific shape. I've already told you that's true in general of proteins, not just enzymes, any protein, right? Whatever the specific function of a protein is, which is diverse, it has that function because of its shape. Well, that's clearly true for enzymes because you have to have the right shaped active site to accept a substrate. Well, another point of this slide, the reason that you see it in bead form on the left, is that all of the information necessary for this enzyme to have its tertiary shape, its overall shape as an enzyme, exists already in primary structure. The primary structure is shown on the left, right? This is a polypeptide that has just been made. It hasn't yet folded up into its three-dimensional shape. But it has all the information it needs just by virtue of its specific amino acid sequence for it to fold up specifically into this shape, which is why if you make many copies of this, they're going to keep folding the same way into the same three-dimensional enzyme structure. And the reason that occurs is for things we've already discussed, right? It's because of interaction between non-adjacent R groups in that polypeptide chain. Okay, now, I just talked about enzyme specificity. In slide 3, we're looking at an example of a biochemical reaction, the conversion of fumarate into succinate, and why this occurs is not important at this point. This is just an example of a chemical reaction. This has its own enzyme. That's part of specificity, right? The fact that enzymes are specific and will work on just one or a very few number of kinds of substrates means that since we have thousands of chemical reactions that need to occur, we actually need thousands of different kinds of enzymes. We don't just have one master enzyme. But that's a good thing, right? It might seem easier to just have one enzyme that would work for all the biochemical reactions. But if that were true, then that means all of your biochemical reactions would be occurring at the same time, always, as long as that enzyme exists. Well, that would be bad news, right? You need to turn some pathways on and other pathways off. And you can do that if you have an enzyme basically for every chemical reaction that your cell performs, which is almost the case. So having substrate specificity allows cells to have exquisite control over the biochemical pathways that occur within the cell. All right. Since almost none of these reactions, even the spontaneous ones, are going to occur in any time soon on their own, that means you can effectively totally shut down a pathway if all you do is disable the enzyme. This is how we exercise control over biochemistry. We make enzymes often and have them around ready to go, but not in their active form yet. They're switchable, basically. You can switch them on and off by mechanisms we'll talk about later. But by switching the enzymes on and off, you're effectively switching on or off that biochemical pathway. Well, this is just an example of one of the highest specificities that we have for enzymes in our cells. The reaction that turns fumarate into succinate is catalyzed by an enzyme that will do this and nothing else. Now, it's reversible, which means the same enzyme can turn succinate into fumarate, can go in either direction. And in fact, it's named for its reverse reaction. It's called succinate dehydrogenase because it will strip hydrogens off of succinate to become fumarate. But anyway, this is a completely specific enzyme. Fumarate is the only thing that this enzyme can use to turn into succinate. Despite the fact, as we see in slide 4, that fumarate and maleate are very, very similar. What are these things with respect to each other? More general term. Yeah, they are isomers of each other. Isomers are compounds that have exactly the same chemical formula, right? In other words, the same types of atoms and the same number of each type. So by looking at the chemical formula, you can't tell whether you have one isomer or the other. You have to use the name or a structural formula like this. So these are very similar, and either one of them chemically could be turned into succinate, but not by that enzyme. Because of that, you know, that little change in the geometry is enough for it not to interact with the active site well enough for it to be catalyzed by that enzyme. Okay, now to 5. In this table, we can see that biochemists got together and decided that there are going to be standard kinds of enzymes, and they came up with 6 classes, as you see here. And these are broad classes, so there's many, many, many examples of each type of these. Like I said, there's thousands of enzymes. Whichever of the thousands of enzymes operating in your body you're talking about, it belongs to one of these 6 classes. That's the point here. And oxidoreductases, well, that name gives it away, right? These are ones that are involved in redox or oxidation reduction reactions. Many of which we'll talk about once we get to specific pathways. The examples here don't really matter, and don't memorize these examples, but it just gives you an example of an oxidoreductase. Alcohol dehydrogenase is the thing that you use to become undrunk. It will oxidize ethanol. Ethanol is beverage alcohol, whether it's beer, wine, or booze, it's all ethanol, just one type of alcohol, but the only type of alcohol you should be drinking. There's all kinds of dehydrogenases that are used in processing of fuels because of what I was talking about earlier. You use your fuels by oxidizing them. And by oxidizing them, usually you're picking off the hydrogens from that carbon skeleton. That's how you get the energy out of it. So those are dehydrogenases. But the dehydrogenase is a name telling it what it does. The class is an oxidoreductase. Transferases get called that because, as you see, they will transfer some functional group from one molecule to another. Hexokinase we'll talk about in a different chapter. But in this enzyme operates by transferring a phosphoryl group from one to another. So it's not necessarily a phosphoryl group that needs to be transferred. Any functional group being transferred from one molecule to another is going to be taken care of by a transferase. Hydrolases get their name because they're involved in hydrolysis. That's the process that they catalyze, hydrolysis, which is splitting apart, right? So when you split a bigger molecule into 2 by hydrolysis, it's going to be a hydrolase helping that out. Lyases, removal of a group from or addition of a group to, depending on which directions it's going, a molecule. Okay? So decarboxylase, pyruvate decarboxylase gets its name because a carboxyl group is taken off of the pyruvate. All right? That's a lyase. Isomerases, well named, because they will interconvert between isomers. They'll change one isomer into another, for instance. I mean, that is. Ligases, finally, get their name because ligate means to tie or to bind. And this is why we use the word ligand, right? What does ligand mean? What is a ligand?
It goes into a receptor.
Right, a ligand, a real general term. there's all kinds of examples of ligands, but a ligand is something that binds to something else. So signal molecules like hormones or neurotransmitters are ligands. There's all kinds of ligands, things that bind to proteins. It's happening all the time. But ligases join two molecules into a single one. So that's an example of where you're going to have two substrates simultaneously binding at an active site on a single enzyme. Yeah. The difference is that in a lyase, it's the group that's being moved is going to be put onto its own or taken as its own. Rather than a transferase, the carboxyl will be part of a bigger molecule, if it's a carboxyl, for example, and it'll be put onto another molecule where it's still just part of a bigger molecule, rather than a carboxyl group by itself. All right, let's go to 6. Look at some more graphs. Notice you have temperature dependence and pH dependence here in these top and bottom graphs. The idea here is that temperature and pH are two variables, environmental variables, that can have a drastic effect on proteins in general, and therefore enzymes in particular, because enzymes are proteins. I say a drastic effect, what I mean is drastically affect the function of those proteins, and therefore those enzymes. Well, why is it that temperature and pH have a drastic effect on function of proteins? Because they can have a drastic effect on the shape of a protein. And function comes from the shape, like I've said. So it doesn't have to be much of a shift in either temperature or pH for the protein, the enzyme in this case, to have a pretty drastic shape change. That's going to affect the way that the R groups interact with each other, whether you change the temperature or the pH. And this is exactly why we have elaborate systems in place in our body to ensure that temperature and pH don't vary much from the desired set point. That's part of homeostasis, is to maintain pH and to maintain temperature. In the top, we can see how much of an effect this has. There's two enzymes being compared here, black and green traces. They're the same enzyme, an enzyme that does the same job, but in two different organisms, humans in black and bacteria in green. And notice that each of them has a peak. As we change temperature, the efficacy, or how well that enzyme works, changes. The rate of the reaction simply is a way of measuring how well that enzyme is doing its job of converting reactant into product, right? Substrate into product. The substrate is just another name for the reactant of a catalyzed reaction, right? So that's what enzymes do. They turn substrate into product, and how well they do that can be seen by the rate of reaction. So the higher you are on that trace, the better the enzyme is working, and each of these two enzymes in these two organisms has a temperature at which it works the best. In other words, it has an optimal temperature. And it drops off pretty quickly on either side of that. You get a little too hot, drops off drastically. You get a little too cool, it drops off drastically. But the optimal temperature in these two organisms is totally different, even though the enzyme is doing the same job in both organisms. And it shouldn't surprise you that as part of evolution, enzymes have an optimal temperature in any given organism that pretty well matches the actual temperature at which that organism survives or lives. Yeah. It is a digestive enzyme that helps to break down proteins. So the reason that that the green trace has a peak that's all the way outside of the black trace is because this bacterium happens to be thermophilic. These are bacteria that live at the temperature of boiling water. It would certainly kill a human cell. And that's exactly what would happen to this enzyme. Enzymes are not alive. You don't kill enzymes, but when you get them too hot, what happens? They denature, irreversibly denature. So that totally destroys that enzyme's ability to function as a catalyst. And that's why it comes down all the way to zero. Okay, well, the same for pH. There's an optimum pH for any given enzyme as well. In this case, it's two different enzymes from the same organism, a human. Pepsin and trypsin, both digestive enzymes. But pepsin works, they're similar enzymes in that they both break down proteins. But pepsin works in the stomach, and trypsin works where most digestion occurs, in the small intestine. Well, those two organs have drastically different luminal conditions, right? The pH in the stomach is 1 or 2. Very acidic environment. Well, that matches well pepsin's optimal pH. So it works while it's in the stomach, but when that chyme, which is a mixture of food that you've eaten plus these enzymes that have been secreted by the stomach cells, gets passed into the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine, now it is a drastic increase in pH. It becomes much less acidic, more neutral. Pepsin stops working at that small intestine pH. But the gallbladder is secreting enzymes into the small intestine's duodenum, including trypsin, which works very well at that new pH. Seven. Here we have an enzyme, the same enzyme on both sides. The blue part is the enzyme. The red is the substrate, which in this case is glucose, but it doesn't matter at all what the specific example is. The point here is that not only is there higher degree of specificity between active site and substrate for any given enzyme-substrate pair, but when the substrate binds to the active site, you have something happen that is the general case when a ligand binds to a protein, because a substrate is another example of a ligand. Right? Something that binds. It's temporary binding, but it still binds. And what is that general thing that occurs when a ligand binds to a protein? A shape change, a conformational change in the protein. So when a substrate comes along and fits nicely into that active site, it actually doesn't fit as nicely as it could. But that initial binding of the substrate to the active site causes a conformational change in the protein, such that the active site conforms even better to the substrate. It wraps around it even more than it would before the binding occurs. And since that better fit is brought on by or induced by the presence of the substrate, we call this induced fit. It's kind of analogous to a handshake, right? You have the loose handshake that some people don't like. You know, you meet someone and they're just like a corpse's hand. Or you have the active handshake where when they feel your hand, they wrap theirs around it and give you a firm handshake. That's induced fit. And that induced fit not only increases the bonding, the interaction between enzyme and substrate, but it also, since it kind of encloses or surrounds the substrate, the induced fit decreases the interactivity between the substrate and the aqueous surroundings. So it keeps the substrate from interacting with other things besides what's in there in the active site. 8. Well, notice that this figure is drawn as a cycle. And the reason that's important is because of what I've already told you about catalysts in general. They're reusable. They're not consumed in a reaction because they are not reactants. They are just participants that don't get transformed. And so the general scheme here is that you have a substrate comes in. If it's the right kind of enzyme, it will that substrate will fit well into that active site and will bind, in which case what you have at that moment is an enzyme-substrate complex. And the enzyme-substrate complex undergoes a change while that substrate is bound to the active site. That's something happens, like I said, it can happen in various ways, to reduce the energy of activation. In this specific example, you have sucrose coming in, which is a disaccharide. That's the substrate. So one substrate's coming in, binding to the active site, causing induced fit, and that induced fit, in this case, stresses the bond, the glycosidic linkage between the two constituent monosaccharides that make up sucrose. And after that bond is broken and you now have two monosaccharides, which are the products, they get released from the active site. So glucose and fructose are the constituent monosaccharides. They're on their own now, but upon leaving, upon unbinding from the active site, that's going to cause a conformational change back to the original conformation. And so now the active site is in its unbound form again, ready to take on another sucrose if it's present. So enzymes will keep working as long as they exist and as long as substrates exist. This is why if you don't want them to keep working, you need to either destroy that enzyme or switch it into a shape that won't allow it to work. Okay, now on to slide 9, which is a look at enzyme kinetics. And in this graph, notice we have initial velocity on the y-axis versus substrate concentration. This is not time, this is substrate concentration. Initial velocity refers to how quickly substrate is turned into product right at the beginning. Okay? So this is not a time x-axis, but if you looked at time and you just had a certain concentration of substrate, you would turn substrate into product at a certain rate, but that rate would change over time. Okay? It would slow down because you're using up more and more substrate. It's turning into more and more product. Right? So the very fastest an enzyme is going to work is when you don't have any product. All you have is substrate, which is right at time zero. And however fast it is at that time zero, that is the initial velocity. What this graph is showing you, though, is that the initial velocity for any given enzyme depends on how much substrate is there to begin with. That's what this curve is telling you. Okay? Now, notice the equation here. This is the Michaelis-Menten equation. So we're talking about what is termed Michaelis-Menten enzyme kinetics. And let's make sense of this equation. It says that the velocity of the enzyme, how quickly it turns substrate into product, equals the maximum velocity, how the fastest it could ever work, in other words, times the substrate concentration, whatever it is at that moment, divided by a constant called the Michaelis-Menten constant, which is K sub m. That's just a number, plus the substrate concentration. All right, well, what is this Michaelis-Menten constant? By definition, K sub m is the substrate concentration at which that particular enzyme has an initial velocity that is exactly half of its maximum ever velocity, which is what this dashed line, this short dashed line right here, labeled by half Vmax, is indicating. Vmax, notice overall in the red trace that if you keep adding more and more substrate, or keep starting out with higher and higher amounts of substrate, because each individual point on here is a starting out point, right? But if you run the experiment over and over and you just start out with a higher and higher amount of substrate to begin with, the enzyme will work better. It'll have a higher velocity. That makes sense, right? The more substrate there is, the more binding between substrate and enzyme. But it's not a linear relationship. It's asymptotic. It plateaus out at the dashed line at the top, the value of Vmax. Now, this also makes sense, right? Because enzymes are saturable. There's a finite amount of enzyme in your mixture. There's a certain number of enzyme molecules. If you keep adding substrate molecules, eventually you'll get to the point where every single enzyme is full of substrate at that moment. It's already busy. Adding more substrate isn't going to speed anything up at that point, right? I usually use the analogy of turnstiles at a stadium. If you're trying to get in to watch the Diamondbacks, and you show up very early, there's going to be plenty of turnstiles for you to choose from. You can get right in. But when the crowd shows up right before first pitch, you have to wait because there's only so many turnstiles. There's only so many enzymes to work at a given moment, and adding more substrate isn't going to speed things up. That's why it has an asymptote. So that's why there is a Vmax, but exactly half of that Vmax, which is this value right here, occurs for some particular substrate concentration, and the X value, in other words. And that particular substrate concentration that will give you one half of Vmax is by definition K sub M. So always remember that K sub M is a value of substrate concentration. It's not the substrate concentration necessarily that you have, it's just the one that would give you half of Vmax. All right? Mathematically, the reason, I mean, let's think about what this means mathematically. If you actually do have the substrate concentration equaling Km, then that means bracket S equals Km at that point, right? And therefore, you ignore the Vmax on the top, you have bracket S over 2 bracket S. Right? Mathematically? In other words, this part of it is just 1 half. 1 half times Vmax. Right? That's why it makes sense. But also, if your substrate concentration is much greater than Vmax, yes, you're going to have a higher initial velocity, but changing the substrate concentration, once you're already over here to the right, changing it doesn't have much of an effect on the velocity because it's already plateauing out. On the other hand, if you're below Km, changing the substrate concentration has a very drastic effect in the actual velocity. That's what's important about that. Well, let me see if I can squeeze slide 10 in. In this table, we have Km values and Kcat values. Kcat is an enzyme constant. It's a rate constant. Now, catalysis usually doesn't happen in just one step. So if you think about it in terms of a mechanism in chemistry for how you get from point A to point B, there could be several steps, but there's going to be one step that's the slowest of all of them, and therefore that one step is the rate-limiting step, and that's going to really determine how quickly the enzyme works, whatever that rate-limiting step is. So that's really what Kcat is. It is a rate constant that is the for the limiting step in a catalyzed reaction. But practically, what I want you to think of as KCAT as being is how well this enzyme works in terms of transforming substrate into product in a given amount of time. And that's why the units are inverse seconds. Okay? So the higher this value of KCAT is, the more product is being produced out of substrate. And some of these are very high numbers, right? 1 times 10 to the 6th, and this isn't the fastest one, this is just the fastest one on this table. That's a million, right? That means a million substrate molecules get turned into product per second by that single enzyme molecule, which you might have many hundreds of thousands of working at the same time. So very drastic increase in reaction rate by enzymes in general. As a kind of a broad average, any given enzyme accelerates a reaction at least a million times beyond what it would do without the enzyme's help. Okay.